Shipwreck rate has declined from one ship lost each day when the sociologist Charles Perrow originally published his classic Normal Accidents in 1984 to fewer than half that number in 2016. But the high seas are still a throwback to buccaneering 19th century entrepreneurship. In 2015, the New York Times even ran a series, The Outlaw Ocean, on chaotic and exploitive conditions at sea. Perrow calls marine transport an error-inducing system. There is no counterpart to the North American wilderness's death by GPS at sea, yet location systems do have common weaknesses. Radar, for example, encourages captains to order high speed, yet as with travelers, their conduct under stress is sometimes mysteriously perverse. While radar gives ships, even in fog, a clear sense of other vessels in their neighborhood and ample time to avoid them, and while there are clear rules for such encounters, marine experts have long recognized the radar-assisted collision, in which two ships converge despite all safeguards. According to a report later published by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, newer location technologies like integrated charts have not changed the problem. Bad decisions at sea have much in common with those of GPS-equipped motorists. Each can become so reliant on the technological aid that its information, and new systems provide ever more of it, can interfere with perception of actual surroundings. In the absence of strong visual clues, and with the most advanced navigational apparatus, even nuclear submarines of the European allies, France, and the United Kingdom collided, although without serious damage, as recently as 2009. The sinking of one of the Mediterranean's largest cruise ships, the Costa Concordia, in 2012, showed how electronic navigation could, like conventional radar before it, make navigation riskier. The ship was only 300 meters from the shore of an island where it was supposed to pass in a traditional salute when it struck a rock and sank, killing 32 passengers. As is often the case in disasters, there were multiple failures, especially of lifeboat evacuation, as the ship listed, and the captain was sentenced to a 16-year prison term for manslaughter and other offenses. But the technology was also caught up in an organizational failure. The Costa Concordia had a required modern electronic chart display and information system, ECTIS, that tracked the ship's position against a digitized database of charts. Investigation revealed, however, that the underlying data of such systems may have been transferred from decades-old paper documents. ECTIS systems are designed to sound audible alarms when maneuvers take them into hazardous conditions. In some cases, there are so many alarms that officers switch the system off, false positives being a side effect of efficient safety systems. We will hear this again in Chapter 5 on medicine. The result of this deliberate interruption resembled that of the Air France 447 crew during its autopilot's weather-related switch to manual mode, confusion among the crew. In the Costa Concordia's case, the presence of multiple nationalities and the owner's alleged neglect of onboard training compounded the captain's mismanagement. And the point of the Costa Concordia is that digital equipment like ECTIS and the more advanced navigation systems now available depend on the analog skills of officers and crew working with paper charts and with direct observation. As in education, digital and analog are complementary, not antagonistic. The lessons of flying and of seafaring bear directly on driving. Both the improved accuracy of GPS and its occasional spectacular failures appear to point to a new transportation paradigm, self-driving vehicles. Despite decades of school driver programs, which tend to increase the number of accidents by getting young motorists on the road sooner, and public service announcements by police forces, insurers, and motorist associations, the public's technical understanding of driving and its level of skill are remarkably low. I realized this when I spoke at a meeting of safety engineers and had a chance to hear professionals and even to try out a state-of-the-art driving simulator. I discovered that while corporate safety directors did not neglect what the public supposes to be their responsibility, equipment and training for hazardous jobs like maintaining shade trees with chainsaws and other potentially lethal equipment, much of their attention goes to road safety. The trip to and from the job can be more dangerous than the work itself. Charles Perrow has observed that even though fighter pilots have a nearly 1 in 4 chance of dying in peacetime flights in a 20-year career, more of them die in automobile accidents, just because of the many more hours they spend driving than flying. The U.S. military pays special attention to road safety programs. The Air Force has received a commendation for its Alive at 25 defensive driving campaign for young service members. The risks of distracted driving, especially talking and texting on the road, are well known. Speakerphone conversations are legal almost everywhere in the U.S., even though research has shown them to be comparable in distraction to handheld calls. Severe laws have had limited success in reducing texting while driving, which can be even more distracting. But some of the most serious issues in road safety have little to do directly with new technology. The majority of drivers still do not consistently observe the 2 to 3 second following distance, or one car length per 10 miles per hour, recommended by safety professionals. Yet as one of the other speakers at the Safety Engineering Conference pointed out in his presentation, drivers' motivation for following too close is based on a misperception. They consider it an insult to their manhood or womanhood, as the physicist and automotive safety expert Leonard Evans puts it, when another car passes them and cuts ahead. But according to the speaker, these drivers' mathematics are all wrong. Keeping a safe speed and a safe distance and letting others cut in has an almost imperceptible effect on the time needed for a journey. 2 seconds per occurrence, according to Evans, or a total of a minute or two at most in an hour-long trip. Falling behind is only an illusion. I also learned what I never was told in my own driving lessons, how to adjust side mirrors to virtually eliminate the blind spots that are one of the longest-running problems in automotive safety design. The speaker showed how it is possible to align the side mirrors so that a car passing on the left begins to be visible in a side mirror as soon as it no longer appears in the rearview mirror. Until this happens, the mirrors may seem to show nothing, but the image is there when it is really needed. Once in the simulator, I realized how attentive a good driver needs to be, constantly scanning those mirrors, looking both ways when approaching intersections, and being alert for the unexpected entry of children and pets into the roadway. I had new respect for driving as a high-concentration task. At the same time, I understood how fatiguing it might be to keep up this attention on a long trip. And while we are warned about using smartphones and tablets, research also shows that even talking with passengers and listening to music may degrade performance slightly. A recent generation of driver assists has been directed at common risks. Many automobiles now have lane departure warnings that issue a series of loud beeps when the car drifts across a line, potentially saving the lives of drowsy or daydreaming motorists and those around them. There are also blind spot warnings and automatic braking for pedestrians and other hazards as a backup. Yet with each new safety feature, the paradox of the road becomes more clear. Especially on congested roads, the driver is in a kind of pipeline, being carried along with the flow and unable to escape or affect its course, sometimes subject to mysterious jams caused by nothing more than a form of fluid dynamics once density passes a threshold. Trying to maintain a buffer zone around the car as a kind of air cushion, as some defensive driving authorities advise, means constantly being overtaken by sometimes hostile fellow drivers. While some trucks have proximity sensors to signal following too closely, the technology has reached few automobiles, and unlike their German counterparts, who can levy $450 fines for following too closely. U.S. highway police rarely ticket for tailgating, despite a high rate of deaths from rear-end collisions. And in city driving, as Ari Shulman discovered, a combination of voice instructions, GPS or smartphone screen, and urban street conditions can be more stressful than driving without navigational devices. The self-driving vehicle is thus the outcome of trends long predating civilian global positioning. For example, the automatic transmission, which removed decisions about shift points. In 2017, an average new car had 100 million lines of code, more than twice the complexity of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN with which the Higgs boson was detected. With navigation and entertainment systems sharing an interface, with smooth automatic transmissions that often allow better mileage than remaining manual models, and with adaptive cruise control that not only maintains speed, but automatically slows down when approaching vehicles ahead, the act of driving itself begins to seem anachronistic. Turning full operation over to the machine becomes an attractive alternative, even if the American driver's hallowed assumption that it is no crime to drive 8 miles or so over any speed limit is abandoned to more literal controls. Why should the automobile not become the chauffeur? In the test phase, self-driving cars have a safety record superior to that of the average driver, but not radically so. In February 2016, Google had to acknowledge that one of its self-driving cars was at least partly responsible for a minor collision. There had been 17 accidents per 1.3 million miles Google's fleet had driven since 2009. This was actually higher than the official human driver rate of 0.38 reported accidents per 100,000 miles with property damage, but perhaps equal when unreported conventional minor accidents are taken into account. Autonomous cars are thus already comparable in safety to human drivers. Their sensors and algorithms can recognize even exceptional conditions, like police officers hand-directing traffic. So isn't it more efficient for the car to take over? Isn't that where GPS has been leading us all along? Whether or not the founders of the transportation companies Uber and Lyft originally planned complete automation, they seem on the way to replace many human drivers with fully automated cars. There is an asterisk in Google's statistics. There probably would have been significantly more accidents if the human occupants of Google's cars had not been prompted by the system to take control, 272 times in slightly more than 1 year, plus another 69 incidents in which the human driver switched to manual operation, preventing an accident, in his or her judgment, in 13 of those cases. The enthusiast owner of a luxury all-electric vehicle was killed while operating it in what the maker, Tesla, called autopilot mode, with hands off the steering wheel. Tesla management said that despite the name, directions clearly warned against this practice, and announced that future software versions would not permit hands-free operation. The future of the self-driving car is a crux of algorithmic efficiency. On the side of its inevitability is the power of machine learning, the ability of programs to learn as people do from exposure to countless variations of objects in their surroundings until they are able to recognize, for example, dogs and cats. The achievement of mastery at Go, mentioned earlier, is one mark of the power of algorithms. On the other side is the ubiquity of bugs in all programs. Security experts estimate that 1,000 lines of software code contain between 15 and 50 defects. In the next decade, automobiles may have up to 200 million lines of code. The environment in which vehicles operate is also constantly changing, and the program probably can never include all possible configurations of vehicles, pedestrians, cyclists, and weather conditions. The Tesla fatality, for example, occurred with a white truck of certain dimensions that may not have been perceived accurately as such. Tesla and the supplier of its cameras and video processors, Mobileye, broke off their partnership amid disagreements about the cause of the accident. The paradox of efficiency, as in the other navigation systems we have seen, is that the smoother automatic locomotion becomes, the rarer the need for user intervention will be. But this hands-off capability, in turn, will give drivers fewer opportunities to practice emergency skills, so that their efficiency as operators will decline and may not be adequate when electronic guidance fails. If drivers need to rely less and less often on their own judgment, if autonomous operation becomes a norm, dilemmas are likely to follow. When should automatic systems allow drivers to take over operations? If automobiles are designed as electronic entertainment cocoons rather than windows on their surroundings, detachment of drivers from the road might make it seem inadvisable to let them take over when equipment seems to be malfunctioning. Both permission and denial risk disaster. There are three other caveats to the apparent efficiency of self-driving automobiles. One is the extent of constant human intervention in the software. David A. Mindell, a professor of aeronautical and astronautical engineering and of the history of technology and manufacturing, has underscored how cluttered the software of self-driving cars is with the fixes that engineers have made, adjusting thresholds for distinguishing signals from noise, and adding countless fudge factors. Under the hood, the vision of a self-correcting machine learning turns out to be closer to the patchwork familiar to the users of desktop computer operating systems. One difference is that automotive guidance software must respond to an ever-changing landscape and unpredictable reactions of human drivers, or even of other makers' algorithms. Seemingly autonomous code may be really, Mindell observes, deeply humanly crafted. A second caveat might be called the democratization of local knowledge. If we have lived for a year or two in a place, we know how to avoid bottlenecks and use shortcuts. Some GPS receivers and apps are able to mimic this hard-won experience by real-time reporting of traffic. This can indeed help us use the capacity of the road system more efficiently. With time, motorists in congested areas learn that some back roads can be more efficient at peak hours, or even off-peak, than the highways designated by GPS and services like MapQuest and Google Maps. When these are suburban streets, occasional commuters were usually a small annoyance. A printed guide to Los Angeles road shortcuts, published in 1990, led only to revision of some traffic signs and a ticketing offensive by police. All this changed when Google acquired an Israeli startup called Waze. Waze began as an idealistic project to share road information freely via smartphones without paying the annual subscription fee that many commercial GPS makers charged for traffic updates. Acquired by Google in 2013, Waze is integrated with Google's base maps and now appears to fill the local knowledge gap with both user-contributed information and data on actual user driving times. It may be the ultimate application of the collaborative web, with over 20 million users worldwide in 2015. On its face, Waze embodies the best of radical efficiency, getting full use out of the existing road grid rather than building additional highways, saving fuel, even automatically updating the lowest prices en route, and promoting carpooling and shared rides. The reality is more complex. Traffic does not necessarily flow smoothly through the so-called shortcuts. It is often congested and backed up. Google rightly points out that drivers have a legal right to use the public roads, yet once enough people pool their data to achieve new efficiency, They frustrate each other as well as the business people and homeowners on their routes. Some of the residents vent their frustration by lying to Waze about construction and accidents in their neighborhoods. Google, in turn, tries to screen these out with new algorithms. As a Waze user since early 2017, I have not found any such controversy, at least in congested central New Jersey. I have received important safety warnings, especially regarding potholes, and contributed a few of my own. It is gratifying to be thanked by fellow Wazers. However, the Google Maps base data are in places seriously flawed. Taking a usual route, I was unexpectedly prompted to enter a warehouse complex I had not previously visited. Complying out of curiosity, I came to a busy intersection with not only a no-left-turn sign, but a triangular island all but preventing the turn. Waze prompted me to turn left anyway. Worst of all, when I tried to edit the map online, I found I did not have such privileges yet. Waze also sometimes tempts drivers with the distraction of entering information. Further, the program does not appear to learn a driver's preferred route automatically, though it occasionally shows glimmers of empathy. It mistakes my home location by the equivalent of a city block. My own experience with GPS suggests that the extremely detailed maps needed for autonomous or even semi-autonomous navigation will take years and much human labor to produce, and because of inevitable changes, will never be completely up to date. There are 4 million miles of roads in the United States, and they all will have to be mapped to a tolerance of 4 inches, an order of magnitude greater than the present accuracy of several yards. Mapping and automobile companies say that although equipment for capturing such detailed images costs $100,000 today, the vehicles of the future will compile huge image files as they are driven, data that can be built into new, super-detailed base maps. But countless details can never be gathered so efficiently. For example, houses in gated communities and on other private roads, as well as buildings in apartment complexes that do not follow conventional street numbering systems. That is why Waze and Google Maps confuse my address. While autonomous features can be lifesavers when fog and snow limit visibility, they have difficulty on mountain roads and in avoiding potholes and small animals. Even if conflicts over crowdsourced GPS services like Waze are settled, there is a third social risk. The so-called ride-sharing companies, Uber and Lyft, may try to persuade local authorities to hire them to replace public transportation by subsidizing individual rides. Both companies are planning to convert to autonomous operation. While in principle this could replace low-traffic bus routes or supplement existing service, in practice, if left unchecked, it will probably increase the number of vehicles on the road and add to public budgets. Coupled with underinvestment in public transportation, ride-sharing services actually seem to be increasing road congestion rather than reducing it, as their advocates once promised. In New York City, where surcharges on now declining yellow taxi rides helped fund the subway system, the rise of ride-sharing apps has cost the Metropolitan Transit Authority $28 million since 2014. Deterioration of subway maintenance has in turn led more riders to turn to apps in a dangerous cycle of privatization. Reviewing a University of California at Davis study of transportation in American cities that confirmed the negative effects of ride-sharing apps on urban life, the New York Times writer Emily Badger pointed out that while these services may make travel more efficient for individuals, they make public transportation less efficient for cities and can actually encourage additional trips when people give up private cars. There is also a shortage of funds to modernize outmoded subway signaling systems and replace decades-old rolling stock, even in the booming real estate markets of New York City and Washington, D.C. Conferences on the smart, networked cities of tomorrow seem to coincide with hellish hour-long equipment breakdowns in the cities of today. In addition, Waze, Uber, and Lyft are all hostage to the fragility of both the global positioning system and the vehicular software that depends on it. Cheap GPS jammers have been traded openly on the web and used for years by automobile thieves thwarting tracking devices and by supervision-shy truck drivers as well. The U.S. military is sufficiently alarmed by the possibility of GPS disruption by hostile powers or terrorists that it is developing alternative geolocation networks. Jeeps and Teslas have already been hacked while in motion. Waze and similar platforms are even vulnerable to devices that can create multiple supposedly reliable data sources influential enough to distort the system's information. And nature itself may be hazardous to GPS-controlled vehicles. Seldom mentioned in journalists' encomia to autonomous cars is the growing understanding of the threat of extreme solar weather. The most extreme solar flares propel material called coronal mass ejections, CMEs, capable of disrupting satellite transmissions. In fact, one such disturbance is thought to have interrupted railroad traffic in England as early as 1841, when movement on one line was suspended briefly after telegraphic instruments went haywire. In 1967, a solar storm disabled American missile tracking equipment, risking confrontation when the Soviet Union was initially suspected of jamming. Fortunately, the Air Force's solar observatories soon disclosed the real cause. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, is using new satellite technology to present more detailed images of potential threats and to predict them more accurately, but prevention remains out of the question. To all these threats, the technological policies of the U.S. authorities so far have thus been contradictory. On one hand, the government repeatedly recognizes the serious risk of interruption. On the other hand, its guidelines acknowledge this, but do not set clear security standards, if that is indeed possible. The Federal Automotive Vehicles Policy publication is a thoughtful beginning, but its summary acknowledges that it is guidance rather than rulemaking, deferring the hardest questions. While I can offer no concrete answers either, I will argue later that the devices and software of the autonomous car movement can genuinely improve efficiency if used rightly. So far, we have considered navigation and orientation, and the risks as well as the undoubted advantages of the efficiency of satellite signals and algorithms in finding our way. But more is at stake than moving from point A to point B, or even avoiding pitfalls while doing so. We have also seen how the printed map provides an understanding of a place that the electronic map, despite its flexibility and specificity, cannot. And we have seen evidence that the better a location technology is, the greater the chance that skills, essential if that technology ever fails, will be compromised. There is still more than wayfinding to understanding both familiar and unfamiliar surroundings. We have an ability to form a total understanding of a space, richer than what can be shown on any electronic or paper map, including features that have not yet been identified as such. We may never consciously have noticed a sign on the road, yet we can tell when it has been replaced. I have noticed even the replacement of a small traffic camera at a busy intersection with a larger one, probably because I often wait at that intersection, and the old style became lodged in my memory without my being able to recall it if asked. There is usually no economic payoff in noticing small things like that, except perhaps for detectives and spies. Much of what we call sixth sense and street smarts consists of unconsciously absorbing countless details and becoming alert to changes. This elusive form of knowledge is not usually associated with efficiency, but it should be, because it can alert us to opportunities as well as dangers. A series of scholars have explored the history, sociology, politics, and aesthetics of the environment. With practice, we get to see what maps and GPS screens are unable to render, the present as a series of layers of streets, buildings, and other features like streetlights and manhole covers that have been built up over time and that are often in the course of further evolution. For those who have learned to look, there is often a vestige, if only the foundation of a long-removed gate. While observation is essential, online resources can help us develop that way of looking. On Broadway in Washington Heights, near Manhattan's northernmost point, stands a graffiti-encrusted marble arch inset into an automobile shop, or rather, the shop was constructed without the expense of demolishing the arch. It was once the inhabited gatehouse of a magnificent hillside estate, long displaced by apartment buildings. To some, this will signify our disrespect or grudging respect for the past, to others, the city's capacity for endless renewal, and to still others, some grander principle in nature. But it surely helps in the business of real estate to have an understanding of such changes. They are part of an ongoing process. John Brinkerhoff Jackson, John Stilgo, and other critics and historians of architecture and landscape have described how our familiar world was formed. But the real revolutionary in understanding American places, someone as acute in his vision as South Sea navigators and Inuit hunters, was the journalist Grady Clay. Clay came to the urban landscape during its great upheaval in the 1960s with the fresh eye of a journalist. He perceived and named phenomena hidden in plain sight, patterns and clues waiting to be organized. Drawing on the personality theory of the psychologist George A. Kelly, he realized the world is not just something we perceive, but something we construct actively in our own minds. The mental pictures that we build help us predict and change things. Clay's close-up, How to Read the American City, shows us how our environment was built in layers, the typical American community taking its shape from a path along a riverfront, supplemented by parallel roads as communities grew, attracted to the river but also endangered by flooding. But it is no textbook or manual, and does not pretend to be an economic or political study of urban development. Clay's book is really a call to the exercise of our visual understanding, of our ability to construct a new kind of mental map of our surroundings, something that the most advanced geographic systems alone cannot do. We all know some of them, like gentrifying neighborhood. Others were already established planners' jargon, like toads, temporary, obsolete, abandoned, derelict sites, lulus, locally unwanted land uses, and lighting districts, downtown zones where cities, utilities, and merchants subsidize enhanced illumination to stimulate flagging sales and deter crime. Most of us have passed abandoned farms. Clay explains why they were cultivated in the first place, and why it is uneconomical to resume growing. Boom and bust price cycles. Clay also coined apt terms of his own, like drop zone, a liminal area of declining land values and productive wealth. Neither mainstream paper maps nor consumer electronic databases identify such areas, yet they are often the first thing a traveler notices. They are also indications of underlying political and economic challenges. How many maps or GPS systems, for example, contain codes not just for traffic volume, but for road surface conditions? Not that efficient representation of data is always a good thing for society. In 2012, Microsoft patented a feature for pedestrian GPS that would warn users of high-crime areas, reinforcing racism and segregation, according to critics. The problem is that while genuinely useful for individuals, electronic mapping also reinforces stigma and can be part of a self-fulfilling prophecy. and there is a sad precedent. Federal mortgage guarantee programs of the New Deal era and their associated paper maps institutionalized racial discrimination in housing long before modern geographic information systems became available, beginning in the 1930s and lasting into the 1960s. Geographic discovery goes even beyond the features described by Clay and other explorers of urban and rural spaces, the edges of knowledge. A surprising portion of the world is still unmapped, according to geographers and cartographers. Whole neighborhoods of major cities in Latin America are excluded from Google Street View. Even for the United States, only a few maps are up to the highest European standards for displaying features like the elevation of cities. As the creator of some of the most acclaimed recent U.S. maps, the cartographer Dave Imus has observed, "So many maps are difficult to understand, forcing the eye and mind to work overtime trying to perceive what it's looking at. With GPS directions, you're no more connected with your surroundings than looking for the next turn." The limits of all representations of geographic reality bring us to the complementary skill of wayfinding, which might be called way-losing. Way-losing is productive and instructive disorientation, distraction, wild goose chases, dead ends. Silicon Valley culture still glorifies profiting from failure, even if in practice, resilience often demands a network of well-off friends and family members. Google Maps and Google Street View can still be used for exploration, but the Google mission statement, "Organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful," says nothing about randomness or curiosity or the value of occasionally disorganized information. As Ari Shulman has noted, the conditioning of our expectations by representations did not begin with electronic maps or online image sharing. Even in the heyday of print, it was a challenge to visit sites like the Grand Canyon without having the experience diminished by the familiarity of guidebooks. It might not be a bad thing that GPS directions sometimes take us out of our way, but there is nothing like the lost art of getting lost, as an often repeated phrase puts it. Part of the enjoyment of the old-style road trip, as celebrated in books and films, was encountering people and sites that were not described on any map or in any guide. The goal of Silicon Valley seems to be creation of a personalized, dynamic, ultimate guidebook to the world. Even its definition of serendipity is another description for accessing useful existing knowledge. Consider the scenario envisioned in 2010 by Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, who imagines walking down the streets of a foreign city and having information searched automatically. Did you know? Did you know? This occurred here. This occurred there. Because it knows who I am. It knows what I care about. It knows roughly where I am. And he continues that autonomous search, this ability to tell me things I didn't know but am probably very interested in, is the next great stage of search. That autonomous search can now be implemented by so-called augmented reality, the overlaying of images, video, GPS, and other information in real time on images of places as displayed by cameras on the screens of smartphones and other devices. Some applications, like the Pokemon Go game, a virtual treasure hunt for Pokemon characters, may help people get productively lost if they are not too single-minded about it. On the other hand, in their quest for the characters, players often seem riveted on the screen rather than the surroundings through which the game takes them. Old-style way-losing was different. You could misread a map or take a wrong turn, or a bridge on a carefully planned routing might be unexpectedly closed without good detour signs. Today, there is almost a getting lost industry. The art is a subject of a book by the writer Rebecca Solnit, of a conference by the New American Foundation, and of frequent articles and blog posts. Most people seem to be able to recall a productive incident, yet being lost is not so easy. As Solnit observes, today's urban and suburban hikers and campers no longer have the same familiarity with nature and wilderness skills as 19th century people who had grown up in the countryside. Getting productively lost on road trips and in cities also needs preparation, not in the sense of finding one's way back, but in being able to notice unexpected features and to meet people unaccustomed to travelers. There is a special thrill in seeing something not famous in guidebooks. If travel means ticking off a bucket list of sites efficiently, getting lost can be only a distraction. But many of the most memorable sites are those unfamiliar from the books. When I was an exchange student in Heidelberg in the late 1960s, I saw the castle and other landmarks and lived in a converted patrician house in the center of town across from the historic university center. But what I remember most vividly was a side trip to have a pair of shoes repaired. It was a visit to another century, down a back alley and up a flight of stairs, where I met a small, bent, elderly man who removed the heels and saw that to save money on rubber, the manufacturer had filled them with wooden inserts. I was mildly humiliated when the cobbler cackled, "Ami, Ami," using the Germans' semi-insulting words for Americans, the equivalent of kraut, perhaps a foretaste of the approaching decline of U.S. shoe manufacturing. Yet in writing my dissertation on 19th-century German history, I discovered that the shoe repairer and his little shop and the balcony in a centuries-old courtyard made the artisans I was studying much more vivid. Way-losing is thus efficient in its inefficiency, just as conventional travel has become inefficiently efficient. There are now not only conventional guidebooks, but audio tours and smartphone guides in almost all major museums. Yet the experience, like the first encounter with often reproduced monuments like the Grand Canyon, can be anticlimactic because of saturated exposure. For centuries, seeing an original work in a foreign museum was a privilege of affluent travelers, who had probably seen at best a black-and-white engraving. Now, mass airline travel fills the great collections. The paradox is that because of crowds equipped with smartphones and digital cameras, and because of the demands of conservation and security, it can be hard to appreciate a work at close range. On the other hand, color art photography and reproduction have improved immensely. A growing number of museum collections are available freely as high-definition images online. These images are often made with lighting apparatus that would damage the objects with regular use, but that is allowed for a single session. Museum website viewers can also enlarge details of objects beyond the capability of a normal magnifying glass. And as one art museum director observed to me as we toured an exhibition, younger visitors are seeing the objects only through the devices they are using to record them, even though none of these images will approach the quality achieved by the museum's professional photographers. The inefficient wanderer, on the other hand, will be using his or her time more efficiently by discovering what is less documented or even undocumented. Those will often be the memories that persist longest. Schulman quotes the geographer Yifu Tuan's comment that when we at last encounter the canonical sites, the data of the senses are pushed under in favor of what one is taught to see. And self-driving cars would make it especially difficult to get lost. A human driver can take a turn on a hunch, can slow down in time to visit an unusual site. It is not clear how well autonomous vehicles will be able to react to spontaneous directions. Will a traveler be able to say, "Pull over at the antiques shop with the red sign"? And autonomous vehicles will not have the local knowledge of taxi and limousine drivers whose personalities and interactions are wonderfully unpredictable. The Silicon Valley philosophy fails because private life cannot be run as a business, and even businesses can benefit from unbusinesslike accidents. The algorithmic approach to life can be helpful because the future is often like the past, yet reality has not lost its power to surprise us in ways that enhanced reality can never anticipate. Global positioning systems need not be a threat to real efficiency. The next generation, which will combine signals from land stations with those of satellites to achieve accuracy of inches rather than yards, will make devices more useful than ever. For users of maps and atlases, it is much more efficient to know coordinates instantly than to have to thumb through indexes. GPS might be abused by some hikers and climbers, but it is still a godsend for others. One problem of Silicon Valley, as of some of its critics, is a binary outlook that appears to require a choice between old and new. This is understandable on both sides. The industry, with its high failure rate, needs a vision of change that will sweep away the old. Some opponents of technocracy, conversely, are reluctant to concede any real net benefit. A pragmatic view is to see information technology as a series of complementary layers and adding to our capabilities. It is not only Inuit elders who understand this. The United States military, which took the lead in developing satellite navigation during the Cold War, is also recognizing it. The U.S. Naval Academy, which discontinued teaching celestial navigation in 1998 after a curriculum review, restored it to the course of study in 2010. While even the present GPS is more accurate than traditional methods by orders of magnitude, sextant readings can err by a mile and a half, the risk of disrupted GPS, including defensive disabling of the system in case of enemy attack, is too great to abandon a backup capability, Navy senior officers have concluded. Our challenge is to combine pre-industrial wayfinding, classical printed maps, and the newest navigational technology to realize the best of each mode. The science of geography, which has studied these technological transitions, is a potentially ideal guide, but it has long faced challenges in the United States. Harvard's decision to abolish geography as a program in 1948 was the beginning of the discipline's troubles. Not that it initially seemed a great loss to the field. Harvard's program, in truth, was small, its faculty not top-ranking, and its teaching, according to at least one former graduate student's account, mediocre. Harvard's president, James B. Conant, made a show of inviting an assessment by one of the giants of the field at the time, Isaiah Bowman of the Johns Hopkins University. But instead of following Bowman's recommendations to recast the department along Bowman's own lines, Conant shut it down, having played one faction against another. Conant, though a strong geography student himself in his high school days, did not believe the field was a university subject. It was a prejudice, not a conclusion of a systematic review. But the decision, followed a few years later by the abolition of geography departments at Yale and Columbia, did lasting damage to geography's image nationally. Harvard partly reversed its decision in establishing a Center for Geographic Analysis, though not a department, in 2006. Geography has also been politically fractured from the start. Its 19th century pioneers included both anarchists, the Russian prince Peter Kropotkin, and imperialists, the German founder of geopolitics and teacher of Rudolf Hess, Karl Haushofer. On a visit to Harvard, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, once called for a revival of the field. Yet some of the most influential recent Marxist thinkers have been geographers rather than sociologists or economists. David Harvey and his student Neil Smith. Geographic Information Systems, GIS, are among the most technologically sophisticated tools of social science. But humanistic geographers like Yifu Tuan and David Lowenthal form a strong qualitative tradition. So geographers often seem to have more in common with their colleagues in economics, environmental sciences, sociology, and history than with each other. This has not helped geographic education at the pre-college or college levels. U.S. presidents have had boards of economic advisors, and some historians have suggested a council of their own. But the public seems to share Conant's stereotype, seeing the field as the description of boundaries, cities, and resources, rather than the analysis of relationships and trends. It is an old problem. "We don't do rivers and mountains anymore," a junior Harvard professor replied to Conant's fond memories of his high school days. Perhaps there should have been more old-style political geography after all. President George W. Bush, educated at Andover and Yale, confused, among other nations, Slovakia and Slovenia. Donald J. Trump, a Wharton School alumnus whose first lady was born in Slovenia, astonished Israeli hosts and his own staff alike when he announced in Jerusalem, after a visit to Saudi Arabia, that he had just got back from the Middle East. Paradoxically, Trump's upset Electoral College victory in the 2016 presidential election underscored the power of political maps, as few recent events have. Geography, as the professional study of the spatial dimension of society and human relationships, is thus one of the best illustrations of Robert K. Merton's concept of obliteration by incorporation, cited in Chapter 3. It invigorated sister disciplines so much that they annexed much of its territory. In 1955, the University of Chicago Department of Geography made history with an ambitious published symposium volume, Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth, a landmark in environmental studies. Only 20 years later, the department, the oldest of its kind at a U.S. university, was abolished. Although Chicago now once again has geography professorships and a committee on geographical studies. One of the reasons for the field's rebirth is the rise of satellite imagery and geographic information systems. While traditional and elegant cartography was a prominent part of the French social history movement centered on the journal Annales, few English-speaking scholars followed in the 1960s or 1970s. This apparently discouraging situation is really an opportunity. A revival of interest in spatial literacy, from the earliest school years through graduate studies, is long overdue. And it does not have to wait for a national commission, multi-million-dollar planning grants, curricular guidelines, and the rest of the apparatus of educational change. Teaching can certainly help in spatial awareness, but the skills of wayfinding and way-losing are within everybody's reach. It begins with the family. Even a shopping trip to a supermarket can be, with a little preparation, a highly educational experience. Why are food stores located where they are? Why is produce nearly always near the entrance and milk far from it? We are all instinctively geographers. We don't learn to navigate space efficiently. It often takes trial and error. It is an encouraging sign that more parents are choosing to raise their children in cities. Observing the city, learning about its layout, the zones of its economic activities, its transportation, can be a visual education in itself. But suburbs, especially older ones, have stories of their own to be discovered. An ordinary automobile or bus ride can be packed with information. The automotive industry has promoted backseat entertainment systems to keep children occupied, and there is nothing necessarily wrong with them, but children and adults should experience their world more and tunnel through it less. There is an in-car gaming system called Miley's with location-sensitive features. It isn't hard to imagine that GPS-equipped software could be used to help children learn more about what they are seeing on a trip, and to involve parents. There is also much to be said for lower-speed transportation. As a visitor to France, I have admired the TGV railroad lines that now travel at up to 320 kilometers / 200 miles per hour. Given airport congestion and security delays, they are often effectively faster than flying, but they change the experience of travel. When I first took a TGV, I noticed two things. First, to sustain the extra high speeds, the lines had been cut through the countryside as directly as possible, avoiding the natural contours and roads usually paralleled by conventional railroads of the 19th and 20th centuries. This is a long-standing trend. In the Princeton, New Jersey area, the main line between New York and Philadelphia originally followed the sometimes meandering route of its predecessor, the Delaware and Raritan Canal. During the Civil War, the present direct right-of-way was laid out to the east. A new human landscape of factories and cities grew up around it. John Stilgo has described the landscape in his book Metropolitan Corridor, and enough remains to record that history. The TGV, with far fewer stops and even straighter layout than 19th-century express lines, loses in sightseeing efficiency what it gains in destination efficiency. The first-time traveler, trying to focus out the window at the usual distance, sees only a blur. The view has to be extended outward at least a mile or so to prevent dizziness, so contact with surroundings is partially lost. In fact, when high-speed lines are built over new and more direct rights-of-way, they are likely to blight the beauty zones that travelers most want to see. This has not always been the case. The rescued Settle-Carlisle Railroad line linking England and Scotland, built at prodigious expense in funds and human life for mainline service in the Victorian era, was still indirect enough to enhance rather than harm the landscape of the Yorkshire Dales. But the planned H2 high-speed train is now feared as a threat to another natural wonder, the Chilterns. In considering travel and the natural and human landscape, we see the ambiguity of the idea of efficiency. One kind is measured by the directness and speed of a trip, so that the ultimate goal may be to eliminate any sense of a journey at all. Airlines flying above the clouds, interstate highways, and high-speed railways all began to break our connections with the landscapes through which we move. The supposed utopia of watching videos in a self-navigating vehicle is the outcome of a process at least a half-century old. As we have seen, though, there is more to efficiency than directness. Systems vulnerable to natural hazards or malicious attack with no human backup can hardly be considered efficient in the long run. Technology that leaves no place for human skills, that even reflects suspicion of them, is paradoxically dependent on the prowess of fallible programmers. Technology that isolates us from the environment does not let us use our travel time to our greatest advantage. There is still reason to be optimistic about travel. Location-based mobile computing can help us avoid its frustrations. It can be pro-serendipitous, help us search for information about our surroundings, as opposed to receiving it passively, and share our discoveries. GPS can be skill-enhancing, not de-skilling, but only if we retain our ability to navigate the old-fashioned, inefficient way without it. Technology, if used rightly, can exercise our built-in GPS rather than allow it to atrophy. Chapter 5. The Managed Body. Why We Are Still Waiting for RoboDoc. In the early 21st century, medicine, unlike commerce, media, education, and geography, is inherently inefficient. When the stakes are life and death, or health, and when norms consider access to good care a fundamental human right, whether or not laws or practice live up to this ideal, cost-benefit analysis is severely limited. Those who deplore the sums spent on end-of-life care dare not argue for systematic euthanasia of the terminally ill. In fact, even veterinarians, who traditionally have seen putting ailing animals out of their misery as both necessary and ethical, now often suffer emotionally when they do end a non-human patient's life. Many animal owners now regard their pets as family members, and some are willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket for complex procedures.